An hour later, Reacher was drifting down Duval Street, thinking about new banking arrangements, choosing a place to eat an early dinner, and wondering why he had lied to Costello. His first conclusion was he would cash up and stick with a roll of bills in his pants pocket. His second conclusion was he would follow his Belgian friend's advice and eat a big steak and ice cream with another two bottles of water. His third conclusion was that he had lied because there had been no reason not to. There was no reason why a private investigator from New York should have been looking for him. He had never lived in New York, or any big northern city. He had never really lived anywhere. That was the defining feature of his life. It made him what he was. He had been born the son of a serving Marine Corps officer, and he had been dragged all over the world from the very day his mother carried him out of the maternity ward of a Berlin infirmary. He had lived nowhere except in an endless blur of different military bases, most of them in distant and inhospitable parts of the globe. Then he had joined the army himself, military police investigator, and lived and served in those same bases all over again until the peace dividend had closed his unit down and cut him loose. Then he had come home to the United States and drifted around like a cheap tourist until he had washed up on the extreme tip of the nation with his savings running out. He had taken a couple of days' work digging holes in the ground, and a couple of days had stretched into a couple of weeks, and the weeks had stretched into months, and he was still there. He had no living relatives anywhere capable of leaving him a fortune in a will. He owed no money. He had never stolen anything, never cheated anybody, never fathered any children. He was on as few pieces of paper as it was possible for a human being to be. He was just about invisible. And he had never known anybody called Jacob. He was sure of that. So whatever Costello wanted, he wasn't interested in it. Certainly not interested enough to come out from under and get involved with anything, because being invisible had become a habit. In the front part of his brain, he knew it was some kind of a complex, alienated response to his situation. 2 years ago, everything had turned upside down. He'd gone from being a big fish in a small pond to being nobody. From being a senior and valued member of a highly structured community to being just one of 270 million anonymous civilians. From being necessary and wanted to being one person too many. From being where someone told him to be every minute of every day to being confronted with 3 million square miles and maybe 40 more years and no map and no schedule. The front part of his brain told him his response was understandable, but defensive. The response of a man who liked solitude, but was worried by loneliness. It told him it was an extremist response, and he should take care with it. But the lizard part of his brain, buried behind the frontal lobes, told him he liked it. He liked the anonymity. He liked his secrecy. It felt warm and comfortable and reassuring. He guarded it. He was friendly and gregarious on the surface, without ever saying much about himself. He liked to pay cash and travel by road. He was never on any passenger manifests or credit card carbons. He told nobody his name. In Key West, he had checked into a cheap motel under the name Harry S. Truman. Scanning back through the register, he had seen he wasn't unique. Most of the 41 presidents had stayed there, even the ones nobody had heard of, like John Tyler and Franklin Pierce. He had found names did not mean much in the Keys. People just waved and smiled and said hello. They all assumed everybody had something to be private about. He was comfortable there. Too comfortable to be in any hurry to leave. He strolled for an hour in the noisy warmth and then ducked off to Val towards a hidden courtyard restaurant where they knew him by sight and had his favorite brand of water and would give him a steak that hung off both sides of the plate at once. The steak came with an egg and fries and a complicated mix of some sort of warm weather vegetables, and the ice cream came with hot chocolate sauce and nuts. He drank another quart of water and followed it with 2 cups of strong black coffee. Pushed back from the table and sat there, satisfied. Okay now? The waitress smiled. Reacher grinned back at her and nodded. It hit the spot, he said. And it looks good on you. It feels good on me. It was true. His next birthday was going to be his 39th, but he felt better than ever. He'd always been fit and strong, but the last 3 months had brought him to a new peak. He was 6'5" and he'd weighed 220 when he left the army. A month after joining the swimming pool gang, the work and the heat had burned him down to 210. Then the next 2 months he'd built back all the way to about 250, all of it pure hard muscle. His workload was prodigious. He figured to shift about 4 tons of earth and rock and sand every day. He had developed a technique of digging and scooping and twisting and throwing the dirt with his shovel so that every part of his body was working out all day long. The result was spectacular. He was burned a deep brown by the sun, and he was in the best shape of his life. Like a condom crammed with walnuts, is what some girl had said. He figured he needed to eat about 10,000 calories a day just to stay level, as well as the 2 gallons of water he needed to drink. So are you working tonight? The waitress asked. Reacher laughed. He was earning money for doing a fitness regime most people would pay a fortune for at any shiny city gymnasium, and now he was headed for his evening job, which was something else he got paid for that most men would gladly do for free. He was the bouncer in the nude bar Costello had mentioned, on Duval. He sat in there all night with no shirt on, looking tough, drinking free drinks and making sure the naked women didn't get hassled. Then somebody gave him $50 for it. It's a chore, he said, but somebody's got to do it, I guess. The girl laughed with him, and he paid his check and headed back to the street. 1,500 miles to the north, just below Wall Street in New York City. The chief executive officer took the elevator down 2 floors to the finance director's suite. The 2 men went into the inner office together and sat side by side behind the desk. It was the kind of expensive office and expensive desk that get specified and paid for when times are good, and then sit there like a sullen reproach when times turn bad. It was a high-floor office, dark rosewood all over the place, cream linen window blinds, brass accents, a huge slab of a desk, an Italian table light, a big computer that had cost more than it needed to. The computer was glowing and waiting for a password. The CEO typed it in and hit enter, and the screen redrew into a spreadsheet. It was the only spreadsheet that told the truth about the company, which was why it was protected by a password. Are we going to make it? The CEO asked. That day had been D-Day. D stood for downsizing. Their human resources manager out at the manufacturing plant on Long Island had been busy since 8 o'clock that morning. His secretary had rustled up a long line of chairs in the corridor outside his office, and the chairs had been filled with a long line of people. The people had waited most of the day, shuffling up one place every 5 minutes, then shuffling off the end of the line into the human resources manager's office for a 5-minute interview that terminated their livelihoods. Thank you and goodbye. Are we going to make it? The CEO asked again. The finance director was copying large numbers onto a sheet of paper. He subtracted one from another and looked at a calendar. He shrugged. In theory, yes, he said. In practice, no. No, the CEO repeated. It's the time factor, the finance director said. We did the right thing out at the plant, no doubt about that. 80% of the people gone saves us 91% of the payroll because we only kept the cheap ones. But we paid them all up to the end of next month, so the cash flow enhancement doesn't hit us for 6 weeks. And in fact, right now, the cash flow gets much worse because the little bastards are all out there cashing a 6-week paycheck. The CEO sighed and nodded. So how much do we need? The finance director used the mouse and expanded a window. $1.1 million, he said. For 6 weeks. Bank? Forget it, the finance director said. I'm over there every day kissing ass just to keep what we already owe them. I ask for more, they'll laugh in my face. Worse things could happen to you, the CEO said. That's not the point, the finance director said. The point is, they get a sniff we're still not healthy, they'll call those loans in a heartbeat. The CEO drummed his fingers on the rosewood and shrugged. I'll sell some stock, he said. The finance director shook his head. You can't, he said patiently. You put stock in the market, the price will go through the floor. Our existing borrowing is secured on stock. And if it gets any more worthless, they'll close us down tomorrow. Shit, the CEO said. We're 6 weeks away. I'm not going to lose all this for 6 lousy weeks. Not for a lousy $1 million. It's a trivial amount. A trivial amount we haven't got. Gotta be somewhere and we can get it. The finance director made no reply to that, but he was sitting there like he had something more to say. What? The CEO asked him. I heard some talk, he said. Guys I know gossiping. There's maybe somewhere we can go. For 6 weeks, it might be worth it. There's an outfit I heard about. A lender of last resort type of thing. On the level, apparently, the finance director said. Looks very respectable. Big office over in the World Trade Center. He specializes in cases like this. The CEO glared at the screen. Cases like what? Like this, the finance director repeated. Where you're almost home and dry, but the banks are too tight-ass to see it. The CEO nodded and gazed around the office. It was a beautiful place. And his own office was 2 floors higher, on a corner, and even more beautiful. Okay, he said. Do it. I can't do it, the finance director said. This guy won't deal below CEO level. You'll have to do it. It started out a quiet night in the nude bar, a midweek evening in June, way too late for the snowbirds and the spring breakers, too early for the summer vacationers who came down to roast. Not more than maybe 40 people in all night, 2 girls behind the bar, 3 girls out there dancing. Reacher was watching a woman called Crystal. He assumed that was not her real name, but he'd never asked. She was the best. She earned a lot more than Reacher had ever earned as a major in the military police. She spent a percentage of her income running an old black Porsche. Reacher sometimes heard it in the early afternoons, rumbling and blatting around the blocks where he was working. The bar was a long, narrow upstairs room with a runway and a small circular stage with a shiny chrome pole. Snaking around the runway and the stage was a line of chairs. There were mirrors everywhere, and where there weren't, the walls were painted flat black. The whole place pulsed and pounded to loud music, coming out of 6 speakers, serious enough to drown out the roar of the air conditioning. Reacher was at the bar, his back to it, 1/3 of the way into the room. Near enough the door to be seen straight away, far enough into the room that people wouldn't forget he was there. The woman called Crystal had finished her 3rd spot and was hauling a harmless guy backstage for a $20 private show when Reacher saw 2 men emerge at the top of the stairs. Strangers, from the north. Maybe 30 years old, bulky, pale, menacing. Northern tough guys in $1,000 suits and shined shoes, down here in some kind of a big hurry, still dressed for their city office. They were standing at the desk, arguing about the $3 cover charge. The girl at the desk glanced anxiously at Reacher. He slid off his stool, walked over. Problem, guys? He asked. He had used what he called his college kid walk. He had noticed that college boys walk with a curious, tensed-up, limping motion, especially on the beach, in their shorts. As if they were so tremendously muscle-bound, they couldn't quite make their limbs operate in the normal way. He thought it made 130-pound teenagers look pretty comical, but he had learned it made a 250-pound, 6-foot-5 guy look pretty scary. The college kid walk was a tool of his new trade, a tool that worked. Certainly the two guys in their $1,000 suits looked reasonably impressed by it. Problem? He asked again. That one word was usually enough. Most guys backed off at that point, but these two didn't. Up close, he felt something coming off them, some kind of a blend of menace and confidence. Some arrogance in there, maybe. A suggestion they normally got their own way, but they were far from home. Far enough south of their own turf to act a little circumspect.
No problem, Tarzan,
the left-hand guy said. Reacher smiled. He had been called a lot of things, but that was a new one. $3 to come in, he said, or it's free to go back downstairs.
We just want to speak with somebody, the right-hand guy said.
Accents from both of them, from somewhere in New York. Reacher shrugged. We don't do too much speaking in here, he said. Music's too loud.